Committee will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1060. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1060 provides a clarification of part of House Bill 3201 from last session. It pertains to certifications made by the Office of Rural Health that would allow certain medical providers to receive certain tax benefits. It just clarifies that the number of certifications that the office may certify is 500 in 08, and then 1,000 in 09, and 1,500 in 2010, and then 2,000 in 2011. The prior language during the administrative rules process, there was some question about the ambiguity in the law, or that it wasn't perfectly clear. So this simply clarifies that law. It doesn't change the policy. And consequently, there's no revenue impact.
Okay, so if I understand, the revenue impact is accounted for in the understanding of the policy that the Legislative Revenue Office had of the bill as it existed, of the law as it exists now.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And this is simply a clarification of that.
That's correct, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Great, thank you. Let's hear from Scott Eklund from the Office of Rural Health.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad, and I'm with the Oregon Office of Rural Health. We're located at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm here to testify in support of the bill. As Chris just said, it clarifies the language so that we can certify 500 people the first year and 500 new people the second year. In other words, carry along the 500 people that we have certified the prior year so that we're not dropping people off every year and so that the 500 new people we certify are in fact new. I also am in support of the bill as it's written because it also clarifies that although this allows a practitioner to get a state income tax credit or a deduction for federal taxable income, that both start with tax year 2008, and that was another point that was not quite clear in the original legislation. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you. Questions? I don't see any.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify this morning on Senate Bill 1060? And I should note that it's my intention to work the bill today, so if you don't testify now, you don't get another chance. I don't see anyone. Oh, yes, General Caldwell, please come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm for your general, Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Military Department. And I would just caution the committee. I think the original intent of the bill, you know, I'm not opposed to this bill. I want to make sure that the committee and go on record to understand that our intent was to try to increase more TRICARE physicians for soldiers and their families. I'm not sure that the way this bill is structured and the way that we're going about it, which is basically those that are currently serving get nothing and new people get a break, I'm not sure it's going to do what we wanted to do. The original intent was to authorize those, at least our original intent, and what we suggested early on, was that those physicians and those medical providers that are currently serving military members and their families would get this deduction, and additional ones would get it as well. That isn't exactly how it all ended up at the end of the last marathon piece of legislation that ended up having about 52 pages to it, I think, before we got done. If you recall, I think.
Mr. Hospital 3201?
Yes, sir.
Thank
that was
you.
The original
yeah.
bill.
Yeah.
So it turned out a little different than what we anticipated. We certainly have no issues with the Office of Rural Health who are trying to administer it. I think that makes sense, and I think these fixes will do that. But I just want to make sure the committee is completely aware that at the end of the day, when we come back in next January and we say, well, how did we do with this, it may not be as beneficial as we had hoped it would be. So that's my point to you, and I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Questions for General Caldwell? I have one then, just to make certain I understand. Do you think that this may lead some existing TRICARE providers to withdraw from providing TRICARE for TRICARE patients?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's entirely possible.
Okay.
But we won't know that until they get out and get on the ground and get it tested a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, so it would be appropriate, I suppose, for you to come back in 2009 to the Veterans Affairs Committee or here and let us know what the answer to that question is.
Yes, sir. I think that is exactly what...
Assuming that you're still here and not perhaps in Washington, D.C. or somewhere else.
Well, I wouldn't cast a vote on that right now.
I guess most would say you or your successor.
I would suggest there are plenty of very qualified people who would be down here with their hat in their hand trying very diligently to get you to come to a different conclusion.
Thank you. Anything else?
On both questions, for that matter.
Thank you, sir.
Yes,
appreciate
sir.
It.
Thank you.
Anything else on... anyone else on SB 1060? I don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on SB 1060 and open a public hearing on SB 1081. Okay. Chris?
I'm working that one, yeah. No, we're working on
this public hearing first. And if I didn't say public hearing, I meant public hearing on SB 1081.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1081 is very similar, let's say identical to 3621, which you heard last week, and it's a simple reconnect bill. I also have, and it's for all the connection to provisions and mainly definitions in federal law that the state applies connects to, like the definitions of charities and so forth. I also have... Or in front of you, there's also a page in the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008 that it's a one-pager, double-sided. It provides some information on the impact of this federal stimulus bill that just passed. But there's no connection to Senate Bill 1081. The passing 1081 has no effect on the stimulus bill. So I guess my question now, would you like me to just talk about 1081 or talk about the Stimulus Act?
I think that it would be useful to hear about both.
Okay. Awesome. Okay.
And I think, I finally found it. I mean, okay. The page you're referring to. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll first go through the Federal Stimulus Act, just to provide that background, because it's been such a high-profile issue as of late, and then talk about a little more about 1081. The Stimulus Act contains three provisions that will affect Oregon tax revenues. Two of those are on the business side. There's a bonus depreciation piece and a Section 179 expensing piece. And those, as you can see in the table there on the front, they will have a negative impact on current revenues. The third piece are the federal tax rebates, which will actually provide an offset. There'll be a revenue gain to Oregon, because those rebates are a reduction in federal tax, which then lowers the federal tax subtraction, thereby increasing Oregon taxes. But just to touch on them briefly, the bonus depreciation is allowed for generally property placed in service in 2008. And as an example of how that would work, say you have a property that costs $10,000 and you want to depreciate it, but 50% of that would be depreciated in the first year, so you'd have $5,000 depreciated in the first year, and then the remaining $5,000 would be depreciated over the life of the property. And so if we say it's a five-year property, depreciated in a straight line, so that $5,000 would be $1,000 in each of those 5 years. So the actual depreciation in that first year is the $1,000 plus the $5,000 bonus depreciation, and that's where that gets that name from. And that's just for property placed in service in 2008, and there are certain requirements on the property. Generally speaking, the property has to have a recovery period of 20 years or less. Is that working?
Are the mics on?
Yeah,
they are. Okay.
Yeah. And that piece itself will result in a revenue loss in 07 or 09 of about $86 million, but then there are revenue gains in the outer biennia of $29 million, $25 million, and $12 million. And that's because it's just a shift in the timing of when these deductions are taken. There will be more deductions in 07, 09 and fewer deductions, all else equal, in later years. So you kind of have this shift.
They aren't quite equal, though, are they?
No, you can go out, as far as you go out, the loss is never fully recouped.
Thank you. Go ahead.
And the section one, moving under the section 179 expensing, is also a business deduction. Under prior law, and we had talked about this in prior meetings, businesses can expense or deduct fully in a single year the property up to the cost of $128,000, and then that amount that can be expensed gets phased out starting at $510,000 on a dollar-for-dollar basis. So to the extent that the cost of the property exceeds $510,000, it gets...
It's the gun show.
And so what the provision does is it increases both of those. The $128,000 is increased to $250,000. So that a large amount of property can be expensed in the first year. And then the phase-out threshold is increased from $510,000 to $800,000. So you can also have a larger amount before it starts to phase out. And again, this provision applies to taxes beginning in 2008. The last piece, the federal tax rebates, provide somewhat of an offset to the revenue impact in the 0709 biennium. Generally speaking, the rebates are $600 for single filers and $1,200 for joint filers, plus $300 per qualifying child. And there are also some provisions there that say that the minimum amount of the rebate will be either $300 for single filers or $600 for doing if certain criteria are met. But generally speaking, it's the $600, $1,200 plus the $300 per child. And the credit is phased out for single filers above $75,000 of AGI and joint filers above $150,000 of AGI. Now, because of the federal tax subtraction and the way that the feds are, this is being implemented into law, it's actually it's a refundable tax credit for the tax year 2008. It's an advance. The payment that people will be getting is an advanced credit. And the way the feds are doing that is once taxpayers send in their 2007 return, that'll be the basis for determining their amount of rebate. And then when taxpayers file their 2008 return, there will be a settling up, if you will. So, for example, in 2007, you have a married couple, no kids, and so they file their 2007 return. Their rebate check would be $1,200. And then, in 2008, they had a child. So when they actually filed their 2008 return, they're now a three-member household. So their rebate would be, their credit would be $1,200 plus $300, so it would be $1,500. So on their 2008 federal tax return, they'll get an additional, there'll be a settling up there. And it's a one-way settling up. If I reverse that example where, say, you have a joint return with a child who is 17, so they're qualifying in 2007, they would get the $1,500 rebate. Now, in 2008, they file their tax return and say their child is no longer qualifying because they're a year older. The feds aren't requiring them to repay that $300. So it's a little bit asymmetric in that respect. But how this affects Oregon is on a 2008 tax return, as you're well aware, in Oregon, there's the federal tax subtraction. And because this is a credit on the 08 return, federal return, it will lower the federal tax subtraction for people. And the consequence of that is it will raise taxes because deductions for Oregon will be a little bit lower. Now, and generally speaking, the people that are affected by that are folks in the middle of the distribution, if you will, because of the cap on the federal tax subtraction, which in 2008, it's indexed to inflation, I believe it's 5,600 or might be 5,700 in 2008. It's indexed to inflation. So if before this refundable credit, a taxpayer has a tax liability of $7,000, and this credit reduces that liability from $7,000 down to $6,000. There's no impact in Oregon because the federal tax subtraction is unchanged. They're above that limit. The other group of taxpayers who are unaffected are on the lower end and who either don't have federal tax to begin with, and so that's the refundable part of the credit at the federal level, so they just get that money back, and they essentially don't have a federal tax subtraction. Or you can have some folks in the middle where, for other reasons, they don't gain the full benefit of the federal tax subtraction, and that would just be a combination of all the deductions that somebody's allowed to take for credits, and that's kind of the mixing pot, if you will, of you throw in all the deductions and then you subtract it from your income, and if your income is completely offset or even turns negative with respect to those deductions, then you're not really benefiting from all of those deductions because you're driven down as low as you can. And so what we have here, or what I put together, is a table there based on our current forecast of tax year 2008 returns. And this is tied to the state economist's forecast, so it's updated for the most recent forecast. But this comes from the Mikerson model. And we can see there that on average there, single filers will get a rebate of about $565. And the impact in Oregon will be an increase in Oregon taxes of an average of $27. Now, this really is kind of a mixing pot. I was trying to balance between burying people with detail and providing something that's actually useful. So in single filers, this includes head of households and married filing separate. And so that's how the average rebate there can actually be above the $600, because there are some kids thrown in the mix there. And then the joint filers are literally just are exactly the joint filers. And you can see how the phase-out affects these folks, and rebates increase from about $464, and they top out in the 60 to 80 income group, and then they phase out. And then the tax change there ranges on an average from $12 for the low-income folks. It peaks at $44 and then trails off pretty quickly. And then there's a similar pattern for the joint filers, where the average rebate is $1,266, and the average tax change is $43. And so the upshot of all of that is, when Oregonians file their tax returns in more or less April of 2009, their federal tax subtraction will be lower, so either they'll either owe more or get a smaller refund. And combined, that's about a $53 million revenue gain to the state from 0709. And so that offsets, to some extent, the revenue loss from the business pieces.
So to summarize, it looks like Oregon individual taxpayers, whether filing singly or jointly, there's an overall federal tax benefit of $1.38 billion, rough numbers.
Yes, sir.
And of that, they would pay the state of Oregon $53.2 million.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. Now, Paul, did you want to add something to this? My recollection is that you did.
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, let's say Revenue Officer. I just wanted to make sure the committee understood how this fits in with the forecast process. As you know, the forecast that was released on Friday gave you an ending balance of projected ending balance of $28 million. And you see from Chris's numbers, the net negative in this biennium is a minus 37. A couple of things in terms of how that fits in with the forecast. Number one is just in terms of the economic effects. The forecast was based on a national projection that did recognize the possibility of a stimulus package, but didn't have the details of this particular package. So the forecast you got last week did not fully incorporate the stimulus package. Our presumption is that will, regardless of your, and some economists argue that this kind of demand stimulus has permanent effects. Others argue it's more temporary. In this case, it is most likely to have its effect in the second half of 08. So we suspect it will have at least an impact the latter part of this year of increasing national economic activity. That feeds directly through our state's econometric model to increase state activity. So I think we can expect that to be fully captured in the June forecast. It is not fully captured in the February forecast. So there will be some offsetting gain from that alone. The second point I wanted to make is, you know, the way the forecast world works, you would literally, if you did a forecast daily, you would have a different number every day, because you would have a different set of information each day, and that information changes daily. So this will be one of a whole broad array of factors that will be built into the June forecast. So I just caution not to take the 28 and 37 and realize, oh my gosh, this is our ending balance now, because it's more complicated than that. There's a number of other factors that will go into play to determining what our best estimate is of where your general fund position is.
Thank you. Questions for Paul before we go ahead with the hearing?
I have one, really, and it's slightly different than what you presented. The error of measure on these kinds of estimates is large enough so that plus 28 or minus 9 are essentially the same number, aren't they, for a budget the size of ours? Essentially, they cluster around zero.
Very much so, Mr. Chair. You're looking at less than 10%. So it is very those kinds of changes are very small in the scheme of things. And of course, you know, if you look at the role that the quarterly forecast plays, is it's to give you an update, a snapshot of where you are at a point in time, and a recognition that your responsibility as a legislature is to ensure that you balance at the end of the biennium.
Thank you. And one further question then on that issue. Our final balance for the biennium is not really available for many, many months after the biennium is over. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, there's a couple of big things that happen that we accrue in the state's accounting system the first 30 days of withholding receipts that we can track back to June. So we don't actually even know the revenue until probably about mid-August for the revenue for the biennium. And the expenditures, even a longer time lag, the books close on general fund expenditures at the end of the calendar year following the biennium. So those numbers are not known until about the 1st of January in this case, the current biennium, 1st of January 2010. And that, of course, will feed into your rainy day fund ending balance distribution. And that won't be done until February or probably February of 2010.
Thank you. My point, I guess, is that given that our projections at this point are, given the size of the budget, very close to zero, there won't be any way of knowing whether we're slightly above or slightly below until at least February of 2010 for the biennium ending June 30th, 2009.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Other questions for Paul?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
And this may be a question for Chris or Paul, but you've given us examples of the individual rebate and how that would affect different taxpayers. Could you say something about the difference between the bonus depreciation and the Section 179? Is there a difference in which kinds of businesses would be using those two? Or are they...
Representative Rosenbaum, the Section 179 expensing is generally used much more among small business. The expensing is really valuable because it's essentially full depreciation in the first year. That's what expensing is. And because of the threshold limits, most of the benefit accrues to relatively smaller businesses who are making those smaller investments of tangible property.
So that part is clear. So typically, who would be using bonus depreciation in Oregon? I don't mean by name, but...
Well, it could be any businesses that are making large investments. But the key there, the delineation there is, I guess, the size of the investment. So you'll have larger businesses who could be investing a couple million dollars in a new piece of fab equipment or anything along those lines. It's really the key there is... It's the tangible property, so it could be manufacturing equipment. It could be a new computer system, I guess, if it's a large enough kind of mainframe, to the extent that those still exist. So it's kind of, it really is the size of the investment, and the smaller companies really aren't going to have $2 million to invest in a single year, or $5 million.
Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Let's go ahead then with our public hearing. And I have four people on the list, and given the seats that we have here, why don't you all come up at once? Chuck Shektoff, Jody Weiser, John Mullen, and Marcia, is it Kelly? And Chuck, you're there. Why don't you begin?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chuck Shektoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm here today in opposition to this bill, mainly because it fails to address the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008. It doesn't address the bonus depreciation that you're taking, or the fact that about half the taxpayers, a little bit more, I believe, will pay taxes on their rebate checks if you do nothing, and those who won't. So some low-income people won't pay taxes on it, on the rebates. As you heard, the very wealthy have lots of federal taxes, won't pay taxes on the rebates. But about half the taxpayers, and as your staff said, it's about the middle of the income. Our calculations show the bulk of them are in the third, middle-income, third quintile and fourth quintile. So we think that you have a vehicle in front of you to address the federal law that the President signed on Wednesday and disconnect. Now, you have to recognize why this is an issue for you is that in 1997, the legislature went to what's called Rolling Reconnect. Rolling Reconnect was put into the Constitution in 1969 on a legislative referral. In 1971, Congress Act, they implemented it statutorily. So it's a permission in the Constitution. It's not required. And it's one of the only areas, few areas, that we delegate lawmaking authority to Congress. And we say on the definition of federal income, the legislature may do that. Then in 1971, Congress acted and the state got into fiscal trouble. And so the 1971 the legislature repealed Rolling Reconnect statutorily. And it went until 1997, when apparently the legislature was comfortable with the way Congress was set up and said, let's let Congress define our definition of taxable income. In 2001, you got hit with it again. The bonus depreciation back then was about $90 million was the estimate. And that, I believe, contributed to the fact that you had over $1 billion revenue shortfall. Bonus depreciation is an ineffective tax rate. Mark Zandi, chief economist at MoodysEconomy.com, not exactly a flaming liberal economist, has calculated that its return on investment is about 27 cents on the dollar, compared to $1.36 of investments in maintaining state services. State government plays a very important role in the economy. If you can maintain Medicaid, for instance, you're bringing $2 into the state for every $1 you spend. So we believe you should put these in. I disagree with legislative counsel's position that they have taken on this bill that you would need a supermajority to do that. For instance, I believe supermajorities are only for the levying of taxes. They're not changing for the basis of a tax. The Attorney General's opinion in 1978 noted that bills for raising revenue need to be narrowly construed, and I'll quote from it, if there were a dual purpose here, the mere existence of non-revenue raising purpose would take the bill out of the Oregon Constitution construction of bills for raising revenue. That's consistent with what your legislative counsel wrote when the three-fifths rule first went into place, answering the question whether a bill that expands the incidence of a tax but does not increase a tax rate, which is what bonus depreciation does. He wrote, the best approach in this situation is to determine why the incidence of tax is being expanded. If the primary purpose is to raise revenue, then the bill is subject to a three-fifths vote. If any other plausible reason exists for the expansion, the bill may not need a three-fifths vote because the term bill for raising revenue is narrowly construed to only apply to bills that levy taxes in the strict sense of the words. What Dexter Johnson wrote back when Measure 25 was approved. If you do nothing with regard to the Economic Stimulus Act, you'll sort of have everybody upset with you. You'll have people who think you should have protected the state's fisc by not going forward with bonus depreciation, and you'll have about half the taxpayers mad that they're being taxed on it, and the Phil Knights of Oregon aren't. That's not good. The bonus depreciation is just a mistake to make. It's not going to have an impact. It's bizarre that it's in the federal stimulus measure, and you can protect us. And with regard to, you know, the statement earlier by your economist, he's absolutely correct. It changes every day what the forecast is. But the information you have at this moment on this bill is you're seeing numbers go down. If you could push a button and Tom Petoskey could come here and all his models and all his advisors could quickly reach a decision on the new forecast, I guess that would be nice. But you don't have that. You have a revenue forecast from last week, just a week ago, saying you're dangerously close to going in the red, and we're now looking at a hit because of the law that the president signed and that was approved while you've been in special session. And I think it's time to prove the worth of this special session by responding so that both, and you did it in 2001. In 2001, you passed the House Bill 2550. You had the pleasure of the law passing while you were in session, the stimulus, and you gave up $17 million, $16.9 million. Okay, you could treat everybody fairly, that they would not be taxed on the rebate. You don't have the pleasure of waiting until next session, because tax forms will be printed by the time you come into session. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Berger.
Mr. Chair, just a comment on the testimony, yes. And I guess the question for Mr. Shekhatov today is, are you speaking as an economist or a lawyer?
I'm speaking as both. I'm speaking as a concerned citizen about the state's budget, that I do not want to see this legislature have to come into other special sessions and cut vital public services. I know this many in this legislature would like to take care of children who need health care and other very important needs. And in special session, I think we ought to do the job of a special session and respond to something that happened on the federal level versus doing nothing. If you do nothing, you're going to have taxpayers upset, some of whom are going to be taxed on their benefit and some aren't, and you're going to have the bonus depreciation threatening the budget.
Mr. Shekhatov, I am reacting partly to your legal advice that is contrary to the legal advice of our counsel. I will go with counsel's opinion over yours all day, every day. Just be assured of that. As for your advice on the decoupling, as you say, as you well know, because you and I have had many discussions about this, I think at a time when our economy is a little shaky is the time to support the businesses that hire the people, that pay the income taxes, that support the citizens, the tax base of the state. You and I have disagreed on that, and I'm not going to argue it all over again today. Thank you very much. I do appreciate your testimony and your coming in here today, but I think at this juncture, in light of what Mr. Petoskey said about the stimulus package and its importance, and he was positive about it, we asked him about it at the time he was in here, I think now is the time for us to go ahead, go forward with the Reconnect, which has aided Oregonians in an enormous way over the years, and I really, if we were not to do that, I think we would be setting ourselves up for some serious three-fifths vote issues that I don't think we need to go to in this session. So I guess we don't need to argue it further, except that I disagree with you.
I accept that.
And thank you very much for your testimony.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I just would caution the committee to think about the votes many of you took on House Bill 2550 and whether that was the wrong decision back in 2001. I'm not sure. I think it was probably the right decision out of tax fairness to make so that everybody's rebate was treated equally. And this bill doesn't do that. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, but I'm here today on behalf of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, co-chair of that group. Human Services Coalition is about 60 organizations and individuals statewide that is concerned about human service issues. I might just, for very quick background, say that I worked in human services for about 31 years before I retired. when I first came down to my very first session in 1979, I didn't realize at first that there was a significant difference between substantive committees and ways and means and understanding how that process worked. And then through my work in helping to form the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, I really became aware that there was also a very big difference between what ways and means did and what finance and revenue committees did. In thinking about where we are in this session and the discussion that's going on down in Ways and Means, the Human Services Coalition is supporting three bills that have a net impact of about $5 million as they've been recast because the bills have been amended. And so overall, we're really scrapping around for a very limited amount of dollars on the appropriation side for things that are very important as far as health care, housing, services to seniors and people with disabilities. So I would just say that I want to state the obvious is that I'm not an expert in this area, but I do know what the human service needs are out there. And all I would suggest to you is that I just ask that as you're making these deliberations and thinking about both tax expenditures and the economic stimulus package, that you give all of these the due considerations. We were, all I know, dismayed when the revenue forecast came out early in the session, and frankly, we're concerned about future revenue forecasts with a very limited ending balance, thinking that we may face yet cuts off in the future for the human services programs we're very concerned about. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for John? Please. Jody?
Hi, my name is Jody Weiser, and I'm pleased to be here today talking about something different. Do you remember back in 2001 to 2003 when we suddenly saw a lot of big SUVs and Hummers on the street? That was the same kind of legislation that Oregon chose not to act on then, which you could choose or not choose to act on now. That's when bonus depreciation was last an issue that this legislature could address. Back then, we had to face a decision. Well, what were we going to do about the money that might come in to the state to be used as the state uses money, or money that might stay with large businesses in our state? And that year, Oregon lost $90 million, just as we were cutting school days, eliminating people from the Oregon Health Plan, and seeing ourselves as cartoons in the national press. Most states didn't then and won't now follow our lead if we stay connected to bonus depreciation. Today you have before you Senate Bill 1081, but you need to be discussing instead House Bill 3621 with an amendment to disconnect from the federal bonus depreciation program, which will reduce our revenue by over $100 million from current estimates. It's true there's an offset from the bonus that from the extra revenue that comes into the state from money that individuals receive. But that really is our children's and grandchildren's money. And it needs to, if we're going to indebt them with that money, which we don't have any choice about, we should at least leave that money do new things or sustain us through a downturn rather than say we're going to use that to offset gifts that we're giving to big business. Unless you disconnect, we'll have $100 million less than we had expected over the next couple of years. If the downturn continues, we'll be choosing what to cut. If the economy stays put or picks up, we'll have the dollars that we expected all along. You see on the second page of what I've handed you an example. Suppose U.S. Bank, Jeld Wen, Intel, or Kroger's grocery stores, doesn't matter who, any company that pays taxes in Oregon, decides to replace their computer systems in Oregon. This is going to be a major investment. I've used the $20 million figure because I know that the Department of Revenue in the state of Texas invested $22 million in a new computer system, so obviously big agencies or big businesses spend a lot of money when they do this. If they make that kind of commitment, any one of those organizations, it would cost us $12 million that we take basically out of our programs of our state and we give to one of those big businesses. I think it's very unlikely that any of those businesses haven't already made a decision to do that if they're going to. So we're probably not stimulating that purchase. We're just rewarding that purchase with a program that doesn't have any particular aim or goal except to help business. There's in the example how it kind of works with bonus depreciation, and then since there might be some questions about accelerated depreciation, there's a piece under that, but I noticed that Chris gave you pretty much the same thing. The bonus depreciation for the accelerated depreciation for small and mid-sized businesses will now go up to $800,000 of purchases. So it's only going to be larger businesses that are going to be spending more than that and using bonus depreciation. It's our position that you could leave the Section 179 alone, but you really shouldn't leave alone the $100 million that bonus depreciation would give to a few businesses. We won't get it all back either. What some people, like the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation, say is we'll lose about 15%. There's just a sieve in the system. People sell equipment before it's all depreciated or junk it, as the case may be. The Kroger's just took out all of the equipment in my local grocery store and installed new, and they probably hadn't fully depreciated the 10-year-old equipment that they took out when they put in new. So that's the kind of sieve effect. And there's also, according to Wall Street Journal, a much huger effect, because basically we lose interest on that money. So we lose the value of money over time. Only three states, Florida, North Carolina, and Michigan, stand to lose more than Oregon, according to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, which says that bonus depreciation will cost Oregon $102 million. Bonus depreciation has proven to be a poor stimulus for states for a number of reasons. The decision on purchases were made in, probably in 2007, before this bill was entertained. It's not a stimulus. Most of the equipment purchased will come from outside of Oregon. It's not that we're manufacturing this equipment, so we're not going to get manufacturing jobs. Most of the equipment purchased will actually mechanize plants. That will probably reduce employment in the state rather than increasing it over the long term. And much of this equipment will probably be equipment which we've already given significant local and state benefits to. Think of the equipment that's going into the new UPS distribution center, into Genentech, into Solar World. Those are all things that we've already tax benefited, but this will just be an additional tax benefit. Small and medium-sized businesses won't be affected if you stop the bonus depreciation section. If this body is going to be known for good public policy, it must take up House Bill 3621 and amend it to remove Oregon from bonus depreciation. Then we would be keeping the revenues that we've been expecting to get, and we'd be able to continue to fund state troopers, the Oregon Opportunity Grants, transportation improvements, or if we need to extend unemployment benefits, if it comes to that. Any of these efforts would yield $1.36 return in economic growth, whereas bonus depreciation, according to Moody's, will deliver 27 cents. So it's your choice. Vote for disconnect in 2008 or for budget cuts in 2009. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Jody?
Mr. Chair, not necessarily a question for Jody, but I guess I did have a question for the whole panel. I actually didn't hear the testimony earlier this week, or maybe it was last week, quite the same way that, in fact, the economists I've been listening to seem to be looking back on the last recession and saying that
similar stimulus packages had little, if any, effect on the longevity of that recession, and maybe that they sort of coincided with things that were going to happen anyway. But I guess my question to any of you would be that one of the things we repeatedly hear in this committee is what a good position Oregon is in nationally in terms of attracting businesses, and particularly certain businesses that we've targeted, such as renewable energy businesses, because of our low ranking for business taxes, and then other things that make this an appealing place to do business. So I guess my question would be, how does this bonus depreciation, which a lot of you have focused on, fit into that? I mean, is it a blip, or is it just sort of more of the same, or how do you see this fitting into the overall situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee, you know, it wasn't bonus depreciation that, or if we got rid of it, that would have affected our business climate in the last recession. It was being in Doonesbury and on the front page of the New York Times. And you're absolutely right. Congressional Budget Office analysis of the bills that were as they were going through Congress in the final bill notes that bonus depreciation had little, if any, effect the last time. And it's been studied. The benefit of economists have studied what happened 7 years ago, and it didn't work. And so our business climate is, do we have good ports, do we have good roads, do we have courts that are open 5 days a week fully, do we have a public, and we have good public services. That's how you measure the business climate. Business, state and local business taxes nationally are a small cost of doing the business. And companies will play off one state to another, or even within a state, trying to play off people to have a race to the bottom on tax breaks. They'll try to save every penny they can. But as far as decisions about whether businesses locate here, stay here, and grow here, you want businesses not only to come here, and I have concerns about some of the offering tax breaks to get companies to come here, because you want them to set down roots. You want companies who are going to have roots here and are going to stay here and aren't just going to leave, like a Freightliner. You gave them a huge tax break with single sales factor, and you know, a lot of them are going to North Carolina where there's higher taxes, where there's double-weighted sales. Okay? So it's not taxes that make the difference. Why did Freightliner leave? Because they had all their customers and a lot of customers and suppliers around the East Coast. They were too far away. It's not taxes that matter. Vestas is a good example. It's not even getting a corporate headquarters. So the PDC and the city of Portland would bend over backwards to get Vestas, a wind power manufacturer, to put their headquarters in Portland. They're in a subsidized red building. And where did they build their facility? Colorado, for a whole bunch of reasons other than taxes. Even though it had been announced they were going to build it at the port. So even the location of corporate headquarters isn't key. I want a company that's going to manufacture here and stay here and put down good roots that'll last. And it's not a one-time bonus depreciation, which failed the last time. And if we end up in Doonesbury again and in that list of states, where thankfully we're not in the list of states today, we're in the red. About half the states are. We're not in that list. But if we get in there, it's going to affect our bond rating. It's going to make the impact of the initiatives that are on the likely to be on the ballot even more serious. And that's the problem you're facing. So at this moment, you don't have the econometric model, which is just a model. You don't have that of what's our new forecast. But you have the information you have at this moment at this committee hearing is you're giving up money by doing nothing. That's the most upsetting thing, I think, to sit there and not respond to it. You keep hearing, you know, if you weren't in special session when that bill passed, I think it would have been justified to call a special session and respond to it given the forecast that you got a week ago.
Thank you. Others would like to be heard on that question. We haven't heard from Marcia yet, and why don't you identify yourself and go ahead and answer that question.
My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm with the American Association of University Women Public Policy Committee. I'm part of the lobby corps. And I'm always glad to have lots of people talk before me because it then allows me to sort of, okay, somebody said that, I won't say it again, issue. AUW is an organization with 2,000 members in Oregon. We require an associate degree for anyone to join, male or female. And we believe in good state tax policy, and that's the concern that I have. By just connecting to the federal government, you're allowing the people in Washington, D.C., who can deficit spend, to determine Oregon tax policy where we cannot deficit spend. We believe that the Section 179 expensing for small businesses would be helpful to the businesses in our state, but the automatic connection to the bonus depreciation is going to cost us money. Whether it's going to cost us $100 million or $75 million, it still is going to cost Oregon. And we are just in the point where we're somewhat recouping some of the losses that we made to services around the state in the 2001-2003 recession. We haven't recovered them all, and we probably never will. But we have people without mental health treatment that need mental health treatment. We have kids who should be in Head Start who are not in Head Start. And it would be really nice if we could have more kids ready to learn when they go to school and keep them out of the juvenile criminal system, which is a position taken by some of the police chiefs in the state of Oregon as well. Your cohort, Representative Sal Escobar from Medford, has a transit district where they have cut the fixed route service to the medical center, Rogue Valley Medical Center, because it is too costly for them to provide the ADA service that has to go along with a fixed route service. That's the federal policy. The ADA mandate is a federal policy, and every transit district in the state that has fixed route service is in the same position. I know I'm the president of the board of the Salem Transit District. It costs us over $2 million to provide that service. We can use $200,000 of the money that the federal government gives us to provide that service. That's letting federal policy affect Oregon. This is letting federal policy affect Oregon. You've got a committee that's looking at the long-term provision of services by taxation for the whole state at all levels of government and the Blue Ribbon Committee, but they're not going to have solutions now. This is a solution that you could deal with now. You could stop the bleeding by disconnecting on the bonus depreciation. One of the reasons that AUW has gotten so involved in fiscal policy since the 2001 session is because I've always known that you don't have programs unless you have revenue. What we want is some equal revenue. And since ballot measure 5 went into existence, the difference between the individual taxpayer in Oregon and businesses taxpayers in Oregon paying their fair share, the gap has grown and grown and grown, and at some point the gap has to stop. And it's the responsibility of those that we elect to make the tough decisions, to say we in Oregon cannot deficit spend, we don't want to deficit spend, and we don't think that we have to take every tax policy that the people in D.C. can manage to get votes on in order to run the state of Oregon.
Thank you. I take it that also is your direct testimony.
My direct testimony had some other things in it. I have the Moody's chart that talks about the 27% return. I talk about the fact that I sat in this room last week and heard what the revenue forecast was and sat there and shivered because at $28 million, we know we're going to be facing cuts most likely. And I don't want to see those cuts made to programs that are going to get kids out of poverty if they can go to school ready to learn or are going to take care of our older citizens who are in the building today.
Thank you very much. John?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a brief response to Representative Rosenbaum's question. The Human Services Coalition has adopted a set of principles around tax and revenue issues, and one of them is about fairness. And when we think about fairness, we think both about progressivity, but also about who pays. And Marcia just mentioned a bit about tracking the changes that happen between individual taxpayers and what businesses pay in the state. And I'm saying this because I also should disclose that in addition to my work that I do, I'm also president of a company, an independent record label. And I have for years said that I pay $10 a year in corporate income tax. I'd be a fool to pay any more because that's what is owed. But on the other hand, I'm very willing to pay higher taxes. I just think that as part of doing my work as president of a corporation in Oregon, that's something that I owe back to the state and its citizens.
Thank you very much. Other questions? And I should go back, Marcia, and make sure that you've covered what you wanted to say, because we didn't get to you formally.
Well, we sort of did, because I introduced myself. It was just that the question sort of interrupted. And I talked about making sure that we get all the kids who we can get into in pre-K and Oregon pre-K Head Start, because that's a passion. It's also something that really helps our members, because a lot of our members are teachers, and if they have kids ready to learn, kids who, you know, have enough to eat so that they can learn in their classroom, they can do a better job, and we're all better for it, because those kids are going to be the ones who are going to be providing us services. I'm quickly approaching the 15th anniversary of being alive for leap day, and I'm going to be needing those services in the near future, so I want to make sure that the kids get educated. And we're in a city, right? We're in a state capital where 48-50% of the kids in our public schools are on free or reduced lunch. That's why we need tax fairness.
So it's your position that those who were born on leap day 60 years ago are approaching their 15th birthday. Thank you. I now understand how numbers work. Thank you. We're going to hear from Legislative Council at the end, but is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill now? I don't see anyone else. Dexter, why don't you come up and we've heard a number of assertions about the legislature's authority, and perhaps you could talk about that.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. Yeah, what I'd like to do with you, Mr. Chair, is just give a brief background about bills for raising revenue and what that means in a constitutional sense, and then talk a little bit about how that would impact some of the changes you, with the folks who are just up here for advocating.
Yeah, every new bill that comes along teaches me something new about this proposition. So it's always used to have a refresher, always useful to have a refresher. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right, Mr. Chair. I agree it is a kind of a concept that there's endless permutations to this idea. But basically, it's grounded in two different provisions of the Oregon Constitution. The first has been around since the very beginning of statehood, and it says that a bill called Bill for Raising Revenue must originate in the House rather than the Senate. That's colloquially called the Origination Clause. In 1996, following a legislative referral, voters amended the Constitution to require, quote, bills for raising revenue to be passed by a three-fifths majority in each House. So you've got this very old provision of the Constitution contrasted with a relatively new one. And only two Oregon Supreme Court cases have provided any guidance on what both of those provisions mean. There's a number of old cases that deal just with the Origination Clause, but only two cases that deal with both of them. The first of those, Dale versus Kongoski, actually construed the ballot title for the 1996 measure, but it was the first one that said, yes, the phrase, bills for raising revenue, as used in the Origination Clause, the court concluded, had the same meaning for purposes of the three-fifths vote. requirement. And that was pretty much all that case said about that. The second case, however, just came up fairly recently, Bobo versus Kulongoski. And it has given us...
I'm sorry, would you repeat the name?
Bobo, B-O, B-O. It's quite memorable.
Mm-hmm.
versus Kulongoski. And it's given us a little bit more concrete guidance on what the term means. And it basically applies it. It says two things. First, does the bill actually collect or bring money into the state treasury? And second, if the money is brought into the state treasury, does the bill have the essential characteristics of a tax? And by that, Israel begin to get into the interpretation part of it. They didn't spell that out much beyond that, except, again, by reference to some of the older cases, and also to Bobo itself, what the court means by the essential characteristics of a tax is it the money that it brings into the state treasury, is it available for general governmental purposes? Or is it, which indicates a tax, or is it something that benefits a particular group, kind of like a fee, where if a person pays a fee, they get some specific benefit in exchange for that. So those are kind of the factors that you look at when trying to determine whether a bill is a bill for raising revenue. Now let's try and put that framework onto this whole federal connection issue. Right now, there is the Oregon Constitution requires you to adopt provisions of federal law as of a certain date that is not some date in the future. That's the general rule. There is one limited exception to that for the federal definition of taxable income. So it's not the entire universe of federal tax law, but just this definition of federal taxable income. There, the Oregon Constitution permits the legislature to adopt federal changes as they occur automatically. And the current laws that you have enacted also permit that roll-in connection. So whenever Congress makes a change that changes the definition of federal taxable income, the status quo is you automatically adopt that. And the definition of taxable income, by the way, is basically income changed by deductions and subtractions. The economic stimulus bill contains two changes to taxable income in the form of deductions. That is to say, the accelerated depreciation and the expensing provisions, which is a super, I look at it as kind of a super accelerated depreciation because you get to take the whole depreciation in 1 year. Those are changes to federal taxable income, and therefore you, the way existing Oregon law is, you have already adopted those. What the folks who are just up here are advocating for is for you to modify that by saying, well, we're not going to adopt those particular changes, which you are entitled to do.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you were to do that, then the two questions you'd have to ask are, under the Bobo case, does the bill, with this change in it, collect or bring money into the state treasury? And I believe the answer, as your economist will tell you, is yes. Well, I want to talk a little bit about that. But, and if the money that's brought in, does it have the essential characteristics of a tax? And I conclude that means, is it available for general governmental purposes? And is the person who's paying it, the income taxpayer, do they receive a particular benefit as a result of that other than general government services. My conclusion, the answer to that is, it is available for general governmental use. It goes into the general fund. And the person paying it doesn't receive any benefit that they wouldn't receive if they didn't pay it. So, therefore, the two tests in Bobo appear to me to be met. So if you were to disconnect from those two federal provisions on depreciation and expensing, you would essentially be creating a tax under the Bobo case, in my opinion. Now, I want to mention depreciation because, as you probably know, depreciation is one of these things that it's all about when do you take the deduction. And these federal law changes basically accelerate the time when you take it, but they don't actually change the amount you over the entire useful life of the, whatever the property is that you're depreciating. Over the entire life of it, you will depreciate the same amount. However, Paul, you weigh in on this, but my understanding is that the revenue impact estimates at the federal level conclude that the depreciation acceleration that goes on in the federal bill is a net revenue loser for more than 10 years. And you only start to see the money coming back after a 10-year period. So given that, and given the concept of time value of money, and given that I believe revenue impact estimates only go out as far as 6 years, what you have here is, in fact, a net increase if you were to not adopt the federal law. If you adopt the federal law as existing Oregon law requires you, and it just happens automatically, that's a revenue loss going forward for the entire length of time that your staff prepares a revenue estimate. So, with all of that, that's why my conclusion is, if you were to disconnect from this federal law, it would in fact be a bill for raising revenue. And therefore, you could not do it in this bill that you're talking about right now. That's a Senate bill. And
because of the origination.
Because of the origination clause.
Yes.
And then when you get to the, if you were to do it in the other bill, which is a House bill, that requirement is satisfied, but then it will require a three-fifths vote from each House when it got to the floor.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead.
I just want to respond a little to two points that Chuck made. The first is, yes, he mentioned an Attorney General opinion going way back, I believe, to the 1970s that said, well, if a bill has any other purpose, has more than one purpose, and only one of the purposes is to raise revenue, then it's not a bill for raising revenue. Well, and I've read that opinion. It does say that. I note that that opinion was issued when there was only the origination clause in the Constitution, and, of course, you would kind of... that's such an easy thing to avoid, and it doesn't have the same kind of substantive restrictions that this three-fifths vote requirement does. So I question whether that, in light of the three-fifths, continues to be an accurate analysis. It would otherwise simply be a drafting matter. You could always, in every bill, you could raise the income tax rates up to 25%, and, oh, by the way, require income tax returns to be filed on purple paper, and then you'd satisfy the requirement. And that just, legally, I think, is the wrong answer. The other thing is that Chuck referenced an opinion that I wrote in 1997 concerning what the three-fifths vote requirement meant. This was shortly after the voters adopted that. My position has been consistent throughout these 11 years. I don't exactly remember what I was talking about when I was talking about incidents of tax, but I suspect it was this situation. There was an 1885 case in which the Legislative Assembly had repealed a property tax exemption, and the court concluded that was not a bill for raising revenue. Well, you could kind of analogize that to this situation. You're, in effect, for state purposes, repealing the federal deduction here, the super depreciation deduction. Isn't that the same thing? And the answer, I think, is no. The property tax system back in 1880 was a levy-based system. It's not a levy-based system anymore, but it was back then. Let me give you an example of what a levy-based system is, a very simple one, and then we'll see how this analogy doesn't really work. Let's say you had a local government that consisted of four equally valued houses, and the local government imposed an annual property tax of $100. And so two of the houses happened to be exempt, so the two taxable houses would each pay a $50 tax. Now, the legislature comes along and repeals the exemption. The tax remains the same at $100. No more money is being raised. But it's spread out over, the incidence of tax is spread out over four houses, $25 each. I think that's what I was referring to. That is not analogous to repealing an exemption where more money is going to come in a rate-based system like the income tax is.
Now, that levy system we continued to use until Measure 5 passed, didn't we?
Correct. Measure 5 made it a hybrid system, and then Measure 50
entirely
into a rate system.
Right. Thank you. Questions or comments for our attorney?
Mr. Chair, I'm tempted to ask Representative Berger's question, were you testifying as a lawyer or as something else? But obviously this is a debate that's been going on in this building for a really long time, and I'm sure it's not going to end today. And I guess the only question I had is the analysis that says that something is not a tax if the revenue it raises is not being used for general purposes. It's not a bill for raising revenue if the money comes from a source and is used for a specific program. Does that, I mean, in a case like this, if this amount of revenue was used in some way to benefit the same taxpayers that it was paid, does that change the analysis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I think you, this is one of the real murky areas here. I think you really need to show a very close linkage between the payment and the benefit, and the ability, if the person doesn't pay, to forego the benefit. I think that's really the crux of the issue. If you don't pay, do you forego the benefit? So, for example, a hunting license, a classic example, you pay for a hunting license for permission to hunt. You don't pay, you can't lawfully hunt. You forego the benefit. It's contrasted with a tax where you somehow choose not to pay. You're not going to earn this income, so you don't pay, but you're not foregoing any benefit as a result of that. You still get all the general government services you otherwise would.
That sounds awesome. Good luck on devising a way to turn this into a fee.
And Madam Chair, I would submit that whoever was receiving that fee would be a little distressed when it goes away as the depreciation goes forward. And if you look at Chris's structure here, the negative 85 in the 0709 biennium turns to a positive 29 for the, so it will reverse itself very quickly.
Thank you. Other questions or comments for our attorney? Dexter, I suspect this is not the last time we will ask you to talk about this subject.
I suspect so as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on SB 1081, and we'll open a work session on SB 1060. Colleagues, a year or so ago, we started on this bill, and we were talking about clarifying the issue of certificates for TRICARE participation by physicians. And we heard testimony from Scott Eckland about the proposal. We understand, I think, that there's no revenue impact because we already assumed that the changes we were talking about were in the original bill, and then we also heard from General Caldwell that this may not completely work. What's your pleasure? Okay. We'll stand at ease. We're on work session on House Bill 1060. Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1060 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves Senate Bill 1060 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I don't see any. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Burns. Aye. Representative Griffin. Aye. Representative Olson. Aye. Representative Griffin. Aye. Representative Griss. Aye. Representative Rosenbaum. Aye. Representative Witt. Aye. Chair Bonhart. The vote's aye, and with that the motion carries, and the bill will go to the floor.
With a due pass recommendation. Representative Gelser, will you carry?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Gelser will carry, and we'll close the work session on SB 1060. Colleagues, we have one more item on our agenda for information meeting, and we're running short on time, but we will hear from Mazin. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sorry I wasn't with you in that difficult moment. The other funds revenue forecast, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is a process that occurs within the state system because of the importance of it as we look at it. These are the other funds that complete the picture for your revenues that you look at before they go to the expenditures side. So if you look anywhere in your state structure, you'll find the general fund, you'll find the other funds, and you'll find federal funds. And as we know, that many federal funds we don't have over control over it, but the general fund you get the forecast for, and the other fund is what completes that picture. And they become very, very sizable in a lot of sense. Of course, they always talk about the expenditures, but our motto on the revenue committee is, in the beginning, there was revenue. So before they can expend it, if you bring it, they will spend, I guess. Other funds forecast, I remember a long time ago when I first heard about the other funds forecast, I actually got a call from Paul when he was the state economist saying, what is your other funds forecast? We haven't had the other funds forecast yet. And that was a forecast that we do for the legislature because this would be the complete picture where we put these funds under your hands and you'll be looking at them. The important thing that you need to keep in mind, those funds, if there is a shortage in those funds and you don't find enough for the expenditures, the general fund might be liable for these discussions. There is a report that you get, and it is you, the House Revenue Committee and the Senate Revenue Committee, who gets this report every June and December. Those reports put forward to you what the different agencies and the different funds within these agencies are responsible for how they do it and what the expectations of either increase, decreases, and so on. Now, the Office of Economic Analysis is the one that actually compiles this forecast twice a year. This is the same office that gives you the general fund forecast, and this would be the other funds forecast. So we ask them for that discussion. Today with us we have the Deputy State Economist Dave Beck, and however, because of the short of time, Mr. Chair, we would ask their indulgence to come back one more time next week perhaps. We have six agencies today to present to you what kind of revenue outlook that they have and how this revenue outlook looks at this time, how they looked in December, what kind of forecast methodology they do, in order to give you some level of satisfaction, some level of feeling that you have this revenue. It's being looked at, it's in the good hands, they're looking at it, they're analyzing it, and they're looking at all the different forecasts for that. Today, I believe, Mr. Chair, that you have the Department of Transportation, Employment Department, Department of Higher Education, Consumer and Business Services. I'm not sure, do we have mental health? No. But we have Department of Parks and Recreation, and Fish and Wildlife is here today, yes. So these are the departments that came with their presentations and forecasts, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and we will find the right day to reschedule this for your presentation sometime next week.
Thank you. I would suggest that we try to pick a day when we don't have very much else scheduled, because at least a couple of these you could easily spend the whole committee time on by themselves and still have a lot of information that you don't get to. Thank you very much. Is there anything else for the committee for the good of the order? I would suggest that you might want to read at least the first document during the long debates today on the floor. I'm sure you already know, because they're coming from this committee. And with that, we are adjourned.